Please join me in welcoming the keynote speaker of RAIN Summit Atlanta, Jake Shapiro.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm Jake Shapiro. I'm emissary from the Public Radio and Podcasting corner of our universe. And I wanted to talk about podcasting. I know you had a panel on it earlier today, but there's a moment happening, and it's palpably different than it had been before. It's a convergence. We are stuck a little bit with the word podcast, unfortunately. We try our hardest not to use it. The pod itself is no longer even a device anybody's using, so we often talk about shows or radio, but nonetheless, podcasting is the short form. But it's accelerating. There's new investments in technology. There's new content sourcing. There's new platforms. It's an engine of innovation in the space. It's punching above its weight. So symbolically, I think it's actually something we all need to pay attention to, even if it's at the margins of some of your businesses right now. And the question, I guess, is, are we in a bubble? We're sort of in a, potentially another technology bubble. Is this a podcast bubble? Certainly the hype is sort of outpacing some of the metrics, but I don't think so. I think this time it's different. We see some of the fundamentals. The people who've been watching this space understand that some of the fundamentals are really different. There was a moment, which I sort of cite as the mainstreaming moment of this last wave of podcasting, October 8th, 2014, when Ira Glass, host of This American Life, was on Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon. Podcasting was sort of resurging in 2014, but this was a moment where he was announcing Serial, the new podcast that hadn't yet come out. And one of the things that he did was he realized that nobody knew what it was. So he took out his iPad and they went full screen on the Tonight Show.
I'm Ira Glass.
I'm Mary, Irish friend.
And I'm here because we're starting a new podcast. It is the first spin-off show from our program. We're very excited. It's called Serial. And we've come to learn that many of you do not know how to get a podcast. And we thought, like, well, we have to show you how to get a podcast because it's not very hard.
And I thought, I asked you to come here today, Mary.
Because I know how to do it.
Not only do you know how to do it, but you do it every week, right?
Of course. Yeah. Every week. Every week for your show.
I don't need to give away your age, but is it safe to say you are an actual older person?
I'm on the dark side of 85. How's that?
Okay, so Mary, so why don't you explain to us how to do it, how to get a podcast?
Oh, first thing you do is go to the website. That you know.
That's right. Most of you, I have to say, you surely can get yourself to a website. Let's give the web address right now.
When you get there, this is what you will see on the screen. And there's a little arrow over there. You press it, and congratulations, you're listening to a podcast.
So it goes on a bit, but that I thought was just a wonderful moment. And it really was true. Nobody, like, in that audience necessarily even understood. Or if they had, they used to remember having to take their iPod and connect it to their laptop and manage lists and files and transfer things. And so this idea that it was as simple as playing something was fundamental to Serial's success. Serial, as you probably know, went on to have over 100 million downloads. The parodies of it on Saturday Night Live became legendary. There were podcasts about the podcast that are more popular than most podcasts. And it was a great launch pad, of course. Having This American Life promote a new show was a great visible way to do it. Although that team, I remember talking to them on the eve of it, they thought they might get 200,000 or 300,000 downloads. They had no idea what was coming. And it was part that, of course, the nature of the content was so extraordinary and the storytelling was so good, and that people were now attuned enough to being able to say, hey, this is something awesome, go find it, and you won't have to jump through all those hurdles, that it actually worked. And it was symbolic, too, of what's been a leading category around story-driven, sound-rich, narrative podcasts, many of which have come out of the public radio tradition, but many of which are instructive for things that I'm starting to see happen in many other categories. When I think about it, I think this is the third wave of podcasting. It's good to take a little step back and remember this history in its humble beginning back in 2003. I was actually at this conference table in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when Dave Weiner, a blogging pioneer, and Chris Lydon, my former boss, host of a show called The Connection. Chris was up going to New Hampshire recording audio from the primaries, and Dave was sick of having to go check his website for the latest audio file and literally said, like, why couldn't we just stick this in an enclosure in an RSS feed? And they jammed it together and began this sort of simple thing that started to take off. And it really did, and it sort of carried with it some of that passion and sort of democratic expression that blogging had seemed to be harnessing at that time. Like, everybody's going to be a broadcaster, everybody's going to be a podcaster, everybody a writer and a blogger. That wave, that sort of first wave, I feel like sort of catched us up to about 2005 when iTunes incorporated podcasting. So they had nothing to do with this invention. Apple did not, even despite the pod. But in 2005, they incorporated it in, and as I was talking to some investor about this space, he said, you know, that's when they licked the cookie. So they kind of touched it, never really took it off the table, but kind of ruined it for everybody. And actually, that kind of quelled a whole bunch of investment in the space. And I distinctly remember it was 10 years ago this fall or earlier this summer that I went and visited out in South Park in San Francisco. I visited Odeo, which was the brilliant new platform that had just gotten set up to help with the publishing tools and sharing tools around podcasting and a discovery engine. And it was really amazingly designed by Ev Williams, the former guy who started Blogger. But when iTunes stepped in, they basically realized they had to give up the business because there was going to be no further growth and investment. Luckily, they had been messing with a little idea in the back office, which became Twitter, which is pretty awesome. That was the pivot for Odeo. But that also basically was the end of that wave. The next wave was the iPhone. I couldn't find a picture of the iPhone, so I had to use this one. But so, you know, 2008, you know, it happened. PRX, we jumped in early. Part of our role was to be sort of an R&D shop for public radio, and we built the first public radio player iOS app. And everybody realized who was in the radio business that these were suddenly going to be radios in everybody's pocket. This is around the time that Stitcher started, and so the first wave of these apps that began to try to translate podcasting to something more accessible began. And that propagation just continued. It took a long time. So the smartphone arrived, but it took quite a while until basically now. It feels like the convergence around the adoption of mobile and the widespread broadband and the rise and the lingering of podcasts that kind of held on by its fingertips. If you look at the adoption, it just sat sort of flat for a long time, has led us to a moment in the last 18 months where it's fundamentally changed. And so why now? Well, first, of course, it is mobile. So billions of radios, the ubiquity of that, as has been discussed on the panel before and elsewhere, is just a huge change. I like that stat that says 75% of people admit to using their mobile phone in the bathroom, and the keyword being admit. I'm sure it's higher than that. But if radio is an intimate medium, the smartphone is way more intimate. It's with us all the time. I'd say the other fundamental trend, and this one is a driver of the current wave, is just the pervasiveness of on-demand. YouTube and Netflix taught consumers that good things were going to be available to them at their fingertips, that it was going to be easy to use, streamlined, findable. Someone would tell them about a great TV show, and they'd just go find it. That had not really been the expectation, if you think about it, 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, that on-demand was just an expectation of mainstream media, and that really has changed. And then lastly, and this is what we're very close to at PRX and what I think is an engine for this current wave, is how talent is reacting to this and where it's coming from. As you know, talent in radio has a major gate to get through. You know, it's a broadcast channel. It's managed in a different way. Talent in podcasting is much like the internet itself. It's bottoms up. It's open, which is a very democratic mode of getting into the business. It doesn't mean talent's any more well dispersed. It's a very unevenly distributed. There's a lot of mediocrity out there, and it's even more apparent when you're looking through the long tail of the podcast list. But it does mean that surprising, unexpected, risk-taking talent can emerge, and that now that podcasting is starting to be not just possible, but viable, where there's some revenue coming in and audience numbers growing, we're starting to see the podcast talent and the radio talent from within our industry, but also adjacent industries. We're now getting pitched from writers and from musicians and from people from Hollywood and film and television merging into podcasting because they see a new creative form and a new audience there. And that same surge of talent that we've seen transform the video industry with the multi-channel networks of YouTube and this entire new ecosystem that's developing around that, we see the signs of that starting to take root in audio and podcasting and in radio, which is fabulous because that has actually been a risk for the industry where the best talented people have been leaving or not finding a path through in the pyramid hierarchies of the traditional radio channels, whether those channels are on broadcast or on streaming. It should be said, though, that is a very steep drop off of the long tail. So if you're looking at the 300,000 podcasts in iTunes, and I think it's about that many, it's really less than 1% that are driving the lion's share of the total listening and that are any good. If you start to like sort of spot check down that tail, it's some pretty bad stuff. Now, granted, some of it is serving a different purpose, just like a blog would. There are content marketers who are creating a podcast to reach the 20 people that they know they need to influence or the 200 people, and that's fine. But in terms of mass entertainment or something that can engage big audiences, we're still at the nascent days of creating a talent pool and a methodology and formats that are going to take root and get there. So what are we looking at? We're looking at, it's about 46 million monthly listeners, which is about double where it was back in 2008. I'd say over half of that is mobile listening. Surprising, actually, a fair amount of it is still on desktop, people listening at work and at home. The median age of podcast listeners is 30. It's a millennial medium, which, of course, skews a bit because of the adoption of the technology, but no longer. That's now changed. And so it's great to see, because radio, I think, is 45 or so, this demographic start to turn into both the audience and the voices behind the microphone, which I think is the loop we're trying to encourage. Apple says there's been about 20 billion downloads. Now, downloads are just a weird thing. Like, why downloads anymore? But that still is an artifact of how the technology works. And we know, and the panel before, I think, was starting to hint at this, that the measurement piece of podcasting is a huge barrier. It's still a broken piece of the problem. We do not measure exactly what's being listened. We just have downloads. They're used differently by everybody. At least in radio, we sort of had the shared fiction of the same statistics. Here, we have various different unshared fictions of what they are, and that results in really inhibiting some of the monetization. It means you hear some of the same crappy ads doing the sort of direct response stuff over and over and over again. And it's starting to change as the platforms get better at sharing that data. But it's really amazing to just see that those downloads represent a request. Those downloads are somebody seeking a piece of content. Those downloads represent an audience hungry for this, which I think is tremendous. Despite that lack of metrics, the CPMs in podcasting right now are through the roof in terms of at least the top popular shows. At Radiotopia, we're getting anywhere from $20 to $30 CPMs. Some others are getting $50. Some are getting $100 CPMs for limited inventory in the top shows. But nonetheless, it's educating some of those brands and sponsors that this is fundamentally something different. In public radio, and from our tradition, we don't just rely on advertising. And we see a great opportunity to tie in how crowdfunding and subscriptions could work in this space, which we're just beginning to experiment with as well. But there's another point about all this that it's almost more of a metaphor about where we are and why I think this is a fundamental change, which is unlike other versions of what radio on internet has tried to do, podcasting is much more like the internet itself. It's really something that's more native to how the technology worked from the beginning of the internet instead of streaming and broadcast. It's unbundling the way that talk has worked and on-demand services have done for music. It's built on an open standard, one of the last ones left of RSS, where like email or like HTML or other things that are the protocols of the internet that have allowed all kinds of innovation to be built on top, podcasting is an open standard. It hasn't been carved off yet like video has, where you know YouTube owns that giant pool of it and Netflix owns its pool of it. Audio right now is still open, which I think is remarkable and means there's all kinds of innovation it can continue to have. And it has that democratic openness participatory part that radio traditionally hasn't had, which means that anybody can play. And it means that there's a different challenge, which is surfacing the quality and curating and discovery. But it means that it's much more like the internet itself, which, as we know, has just led to extraordinary transformation of everything from business to society. And so having that piece fused into audio that's actually reaching a mass audience through mobile is a game-changing turn of events for our industry that is just fundamentally different than all the streams we've put online to date. I was just last week, as a sort of sign of the times, at this summit. As it happens, referring back to that Silicon Valley video, this was at a venture capitalist's like penthouse office in San Francisco doing the podcast summit. So clearly, there is some kind of ROI being investigated here. But it was great to see because this was actually a group, invited group of some of the leading forces in the current podcast moment. You had the mix from NPR and PRX, but also Gimlet, which is sort of straddling these worlds. Audible, which is now heavily investing into original content from the podcast world. ESPN was there. You had Midroll and some of the ad agencies were there. But the purpose was to just sort of share the state of play, and it was to talk about ways in which actually there's this nascent kind of new industry taking shape that feels different. And it doesn't feel like a zero-sum game at this moment. It feels like there's actually a spirit of collaboration. Some of these problems around metrics or other things that could be driven by new standards were a hot topic at this meeting. And a sense that we all need to be trying to educate audiences and advertisers that this is a real thing and that there's ways that we can trade and learn from each other was part of the spirit of that meeting, which I thought was fundamental. You did also get a sense of where the competition is going to be, for sure. And there's a competition for talent already underway. Within public radio, it's fierce because some of the top producers and editors and storytellers are, you know, jumping ship to places like Audible or Gimlet. We're trying to hire them away for Radiotopia as well. And there's a sort of a pipeline problem of people who have at least honed that craft of the serial-like storytelling that really has seemed to resonate with audiences. We work with partners like Transom and AIR who do training of storytelling in public radio. So we're starting to see a life cycle of this take shape, which is really encouraging. I'd also say there's a platform piece of the competition that we're keeping an eye on. To my hope, the openness actually stays true, but you can see the tendency would be to begin to carve off exclusive terrains for content because that'll drive a wedge for adoption of audience. You also see the major music platforms, Spotify, of course, SoundCloud had already been doing this, start to bolt on podcasts into their services as a category. And it's an obvious reason. I mean, you have something like Serial's 100 million downloads, like we should have that. Let's just stick it in the catalog. But also, it's the content that they happen not to have to pay the same rights and royalties and fight with the labels about, so that's kind of nice. Like, we're the rights holders, or a producer is the rights holder. It's simpler that way. But in my mind, actually, this is not going to hold. I don't think bolting on this particular category of spoken word into music services is going to stick, but we shall see, and that's actually part of what the big incumbents fighting out the platform wars in music are trying to figure out on the podcast world, because right now, one of the exciting parts about podcasting is it's up for grabs. Like, this space has not been dominated or organized. Despite iTunes' huge share of it, they never took over the monetization. They never became the YouTube of it. They don't show signs yet of having planned to do that. So there's a lot up for grabs and some really interesting things that we think together we can actually start to define. And that's what we're doing at PRX. PRX, I'll do a short bit on. We launched in 2003, right around that time. And the first wave of the podcasting moment was when we began PRX as just a startup idea. The idea was to build an open distribution marketplace for anybody to be able to put their stories up. And in our case, it was B2B. The buyers were the local public radio stations who needed access, streamlined, efficient access to great stories. And we created that, and over time, it's become a real national network powering hundreds of thousands of stories reaching millions of people. That being our mission of harnessing technology to bring significant stories to millions of people as a nonprofit. As was mentioned in the introduction, we've spun off a for-profit investment arm in San Francisco that invests in startup media companies. But PRX has remained a 501c3 with content distribution and then this role of being kind of R&D. There's so little technology R&D in public radio, and I assume actually this is true in commercial radio, not enough going into adopting and experimenting with cutting-edge technologies, that we sort of fell into doing that because we were a technology shop. And one of the first things we did was, you know, start to play with pub catchers and open source podcast tools. We also created a channel called Remix, which takes the best of all the stories in our huge catalog and puts them into sort of a shuffle mode, which is available in that kind of NPR One-like play-skip mode as an app. It's also a channel on XM, which we snuck in and managed to grab when they merged XM and Sirius. We got a channel for public radio, channel 123. We have that number. If you happen to be in a car, it's easy to remember. And we began building lots of apps, mostly for others, for shows and leading stations. All along, we grew this open marketplace to attract top talent. So This American Life is a show we now distribute exclusively for broadcast and public radio. The Moth, which is a powerhouse of storytelling, started as a live show, and we partnered with them to turn it into a podcast and a radio hour, now on over 500 stations and one of the top 20 podcasts on iTunes. And they, partnering with local stations, put on 430 live Moth storytelling events last year. There's another trend in your communities, which is around storytelling. And storytelling matched with the craving of audiences for this kind of quality story-driven content is an amazing opportunity, both for engagement, but also for some of the brands and sponsors that you're trying to partner with locally. And we also helped this show called 99% Invisible start from scratch and turn into this juggernaut, where Roman got to do an episode at TED not that long ago. And based on partnering with Roman Mars, we started a network called Radiotopia. And this has really been our laboratory for understanding podcasting. We launched it in February of 2014. It now has 13 of the best shows. Some of them are the top ones on iTunes. When we launched, we had about 900,000 downloads a month. And we're now nearing 9 million downloads a month, just a little over a year and a half later, which is just showing the kind of pace of growth of the whole space and of what we've been able to achieve. And we do the mix of selling sponsorships and managing events. But we also did a real important test around crowdfunding, where we went to Kickstarter, and in 30 days, our goal had been to raise $250,000. We raised $620,000 from over 20,000 backers. And these are people basically pledging, volunteering. They're, you know, getting T-shirts and mugs, or sometimes we had one for strangers, the podcast, where they, if they signed up at a certain level, they would get matched with a pen pal. I was convinced this wouldn't work, but 3,000 people signed up, and they now are matched with each other to have pen pal letters around the world because they're fans of the show Strangers. So we think that part of the mix of the future of podcasting is not just to rely on CPMs, which, while they're growing, I guarantee you, will decline. I mean, that's just what happens with digital inventory over time as it gets more efficient and optimized and the dynamic stuff starts to programmatically get inserted. So what else do you hold on to? I don't hope that it becomes fiefdoms of subscription paywalls. I do think there's something in the notion of fans, the true fans, the upside value of those true fans finding a way, as they have in public radio, with no data in public radio about who's listening to what at what time. But if you imagine with that data what you could do, connect fans to the artists and shows they love, that's powerful. Thank you. I think we have some time for questions or ideas or pitches. If you want to pitch us your podcast, now's the time. Go ahead. We can do it. Could it turn into a pitch panel? That's fine.
Hi. My name is Mike Tasted. I'm from Vendasa Technologies. Glad that you brought up podcasting. I'm a huge podcast fan. My fave is Dan Carlin, and he has a great saying on what he calls broadcast station doomsday, where an individual working out of their basement with a laptop commands a larger audience than, say, CNN. And so my question to you is, when do you think that would happen, if it hasn't happened already? And what should broadcasting stations and radio stations do to survive the doomsday?
Got it. That's a great question. It is happening. I don't think they've yet exceeded CNN's audience, but we see, you know, the number one podcast in the last week was this one called Limetown, which are these two NYU film students who got inspired to create a scripted, you know, narrative fiction series and just blew up. And it's amazing that that can happen, you know, in this kind of a moment without the sort of usual means and mechanisms and marketing that you'd have to go with to create that. So it is a powerful trend. There will be individuals or independent entities and new players coming out. I think incumbent stations and networks, but stations in particular, this is a time to embrace this. It's a time to be, I'd say, two things. One is to be the incubator for that talent, to actually say, look, there's somebody either in my shop or in my community who needs something. And this is what Radiotopia does as a network for these producers, is we provide a resource, a back office, a sales force, other things that they need that can't do independently. Station can be that, but it has to have a different relationship that's not an owned and operated one for that individual, for that show. And the basis of that, I think, is a challenge for some of the usual mindsets of operating content business. But encouraging that talent inside and outside as a hub or a platform for new shows, great role for a station. And then the other, I think, is to introduce all of this to your audiences. So a radio station's job is to curate great stuff and present it to audiences. There's this exploding world of podcasts that now, I guarantee you, your audience is starting to hear about from elsewhere. And why not be the place that tells them how to make sense of it? Because that's still a challenge. It's one of the broken pieces of podcasting, is that it's not great in discovery and curation on many of the platforms yet. So be that for your community.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Higgins with Orbital Media Networks. So Radiotopia sounds like one of those cool experiments, and you're seeing really good feedback on it. So what are you doing in terms of finding that talent? Are you scouring the internet and finding who you think the next voice is, or are you doing, you know, auditions and things like that?
Yep, that's a good question. So, I mean, at this stage, because it's become visible and successful enough that there clearly is attracting audience and revenue, we're getting pitched endlessly, so there's that. But we scout a lot. We go listen. We're all listeners, and the team who's behind Radiotopia and the team at PRX is also often listening. In addition to our own catalog, because we run a distribution business, there's lots of new people uploading stories all the time to PRX. We, years ago, ran something called the Public Radio Talent Quest. We wanted to call it This American Idol, but they wouldn't let us do that. But we ran this awesome talent quest, and actually it resulted in two people emerging from completely off the radar. They had submitted two-minute audio segments, and we told people they didn't need recording equipment. They could just leave it on voicemail if they wanted. And two of those ones who came through this 1,500 entries, Glenn Washington and Al Letson, each have now have national shows on NPR And a great success of casting that wide net way beyond the comfort zone of what we usually do. So actually getting outside of our sort of usual gang is part of the challenge. It's a challenge for public radio, and I think for all of us in this room, the diversity. There are not enough women in podcasting, and there are not enough minorities in podcasting. And this is a great way that podcasting can solve that, because it's always been a format, sort of self-fulfilling issue, where the main, in our case, NPR news franchise just didn't speak to certain populations, didn't have room to have them reflected on air. And now we don't have to fight that constraint, and it's a great opportunity to open up all of those kinds of things for talent. I think we're at time. Thanks, everybody.